You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from theheart.org on Medscape.
Hi, everyone. This is John Mandrola from theheart.org on Medscape. This is This Week in Cardiology for May 8th, 2015. This week, I'm talking about the Lariat device, thrombolysis and intervention in acute stroke in patients who are taking the new anticoagulant agents, health literacy and heart failure, 81 or 325 milligrams of aspirin for secondary prevention, fitness and atrial fibrillation, and the issue of informed consent in patients who have ST segment elevation myocardial infarction. First up is the Lariat story. How you feel about the Lariat story turns on how you define the Lariat device. This device is being used and has been used in more than 2,000 cases in the United States for left atrial appendage closure. And of course, left atrial appendage closure is a strategy for stroke prevention in patients with AF. The procedure to place a Lariat device encompasses two of electrophysiology's most treacherous maneuvers. One is transseptal heart catheterization and the other is epicardial puncture. This is a big procedure. But the kicker is that the Lariat device was not approved for left atrial appendage closure. It was merely approved in a FDA loophole of sorts as a soft tissue approximator, a new and improved suture device, if you will. A recent study in JAMA Internal Medicine from a group of investigators in the United States put together all of the world's literature on Lariat. They came up with only five studies on 309 patients. That's it, just five studies. They also reviewed the MAUDE database, which is a self-reported database of adverse events. They published pretty sobering results. The device was only successfully deployed in 90% of patients. 10% weren't successfully deployed. The surgical intervention rate was 2.3%. There was one patient death. The MAUDE database showed more than 20 adverse events, and none of these five trials were randomized trials. They were all just descriptive studies. And the results would have been worse if not for one of the five trials was a 98-patient study from a single center in Poland, and they reported near-perfect results with no serious complications, which, of course, brought the average complication rate down. My comments on this are a couple. One, left atrial appendage occlusion as a stroke prevention strategy is still pretty controversial in my mind. It's a focal strategy for a systemic disease. Second, Boston Scientific had to go through 6 years of research, spend millions of dollars to get their Watchman occlusion device approved as a reasonable and safe strategy. And Lariat gets in as a new and improved suture device. That's notable. Perhaps more notable, though, is the fact that shortly after the FDA approved the Lariat device, the company submitted a patent request for Lariat to be used as a novel means to close the left atrial appendage. I urge you not to look away from the story. Look hard at it, pause, think about what happened here. Michael O'Riordan from HeartWire on Medscape has an excellent story. He dug deep into this. He interviewed the lead investigator of the JAMA Internal Medicine trial, and I'll link it below. Next up is stroke prevention in patients who are taking novel or new anticoagulant drugs, such as direct thrombin inhibitors and 10A inhibitors. Patients on these drugs still have strokes, and if you look at all the clinical trials, it was about 3% stroke rate while taking these drugs. Current guidelines recommend against stroke thrombolysis or intervention in these patients due to an increased risk. But this is not based on any evidence. It's based only on expert opinion. Well, a new study presented at the first ever European Stroke Conference in Scotland suggests that we may want to revisit that expert opinion. These researchers from Basel, Switzerland used registries and patient records to assess outcomes of patients who were on NOACs or vitamin K antagonists or no anticoagulants. They had to do propensity matching to control for confounders, but they found, listen to this, no significant difference in the primary outcome, which was a safety outcome, in patients who were on NOAC drugs. And obviously, propensity matching weakens the findings. You know, there's always the issue of confounding. But this is pretty important news. It goes against prevailing wisdom. And about a year or two ago, I had a patient who had an ischemic stroke on a NOAC whose life was saved by a very courageous stroke intervention team who fixed this problem acutely, even though he was on these drugs and it was against guidelines. So check out our veteran journalist from Medscape Medical News, Sue Hughes, who covers Medscape Neurology, has a great story, a detailed story on this study. That'll be linked below. Next up, health literacy and heart failure. Now, everyone who is involved in the care of patients with heart failure knows the real story. And that is, it requires an engaged patient and family. It's not rocket science taking care of these patients, but it is hard work. A recent study from Vanderbilt University showed that patients with low health literacy have a higher mortality at about 20 month or average 2 year follow-up. This was a small, non-randomized, retrospective study, but I mention it because the role of education and support in heart failure patients cannot really be overstated. And the ACC released today a consensus statement on the value of team-based care in cardiology, and I think this is a perfect example of the benefits of team-based care. Next is the big question, 81 milligrams or 325 milligrams of aspirin for secondary prevention. I mean, how many times have you been asked this? And I didn't know this, but 325 milligram dose of aspirin is simply arbitrary. It was basically what Bayer aspirin could get into a pill and submit for a patent back in the early 1900s. But now a new mega trial will study the two dosing regimens for secondary prevention. The plan is to randomize more than 20,000 patients with significant coronary artery disease. And this will be a PCORI, or Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute-sponsored study. The acronym will be ADAPTABLE, ADAPTABLE. And this is a mentionable thing because it is not just because it's an important clinical question, but also may be a look into the future of clinical research. And namely that we'll be looking more for simple, pragmatic trials, the sorts of research questions that aren't likely to be funded by pharmaceutical companies. All right, next up, fitness and atrial fibrillation. So the relationship between lifestyle and AFib is very well established. Basically, live well and the risk of AF declines. And the interesting thing about fitness and atrial fibrillation is that about every 6 months, a mainstream media story comes out about perhaps exercise can cause arrhythmias or exercise can be dangerous. Do not be misled by this. There may indeed be an upper limit of exercise, endurance exercise specifically, but 99.99% of our patients would benefit and do well to simply be fit, physically fit. And that doesn't mean doing an Ironman triathlon. It just means doing enough regular exercise to be able to perform well on a routine exercise treadmill. A research team led by a group of doctors from Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit, recently published a compelling study in Circulation. in which they demonstrate a gradual inverse relationship between fitness and incident AFib. Simply said, the fitter you are, the less likely you are to develop atrial fibrillation. So the message is clear. Get fit and have rhythm. Finally, informed consent and STEMI research. If two treatments are widely used and we don't know which one is better, and both are used in life-saving situations, say during ST segment elevation infarct, can we study these things without patient consent? And this ethical issue came up in the discussion of the controversial HEAT PPCI trial of heparin versus bivalirudin. And this was a topic of a pro-con debate at the Society of Angiography in San Diego. HeartWire on Medscape journalist Michael Reardon was there, and he's filed a terrific recap of this debate. I find this an interesting topic. It also comes up in, say, research for cardiac arrest. Patients who have STEMIs are often in pain. They can't really give, can't easily give consent, or we certainly can't transmit all of this important information to the patient for them to process during the middle of a heart attack. So what should be done? And another thing I wonder is, let's say I wanted to study two different statin drugs or two different new anticoagulant drugs. Would it be possible to do a computer-driven randomization and then just use EHR to follow these patients without having them go through the informed consent process? I mean, we might choose statin A or statin B or NOAC 1 or NOAC 2 kind of arbitrarily, but wouldn't it be nice to know how these outcomes came up? I don't know the answers, but I did find Mike's story really, really excellent. So this is This Week in Cardiology. Next week is the Heart Rhythm Society meeting in Boston. I'll be taping This Week in Cardiology there, and I look forward to seeing you next week. This is John Mandrola from theheart.org on Medscape. Thank you very much.
You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from theheart.org on Medscape.